Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Just over a year ago on our special episode 200, we met with Jane Gulliford Lowe and James Jeffries to talk about their new podcast on Bomber Command called Nevermind the Dambusters. That podcast's gone on to be a great hit and has gone from strength to strength. It's a really good listen. Please do follow them. Well, today we bring Jane back to talk to us about her latest book. That's called The Invisible Campaign, Bomber Command Gardening Operations, 1940 to 1945. It's published by Morton Books and was published in March 2025. Aerial mining by Bomber Command was a vital part of the Allied war effort, claiming far more tonnage of Axis shipping destroyed than direct attack by either Coastal Command or Bomber Command. Mine laying operations started in April 1940 and expanded dramatically as the war progressed. Yet today, this vital campaign and its wide-ranging achievements against Axis merchant vessels, Kriegsmarine ships and U-boats is virtually unknown. The Invisible Campaign changes that, with a foreword by James Holland and hitting a number one spot on Amazon for the most wished-for book in its category. Jane has so eloquently weaved gardening operations into the context of both Bomber Command and World War II, that it reads so seamlessly, even for the most unschooled reader on Bomber Command history, and almost certainly an education for those who may have thought they'd read it all. Let's welcome Jane to Extended and get stuck into The Invisible Campaign. Jane, welcome back to Extended.
It's lovely to be back again. I can't believe it's so long since we actually last spoke.
too long, and it's down to me that it took us too long to get this organised, but I'm absolutely delighted to have you back. Listen, when we last spoke and we talked about your new podcast, which was in its infancy, last year seems to have been a roller coaster. You know, the book's been on a second print run. You've been featured in interviews and debates and all sorts of things. How's it been for you?
It's been absolutely crazy, to be honest. I've been totally thrilled and very humbled as to how well the book has actually been received. It was because it's such a sort of niche topic, I was quite uncertain as to, you know, how people would respond to it. But hopefully I've been able to strike that balance between sort of popular history and academic history to bring this story to light, really. And yeah, I've been absolutely wowed by the reception and the fantastic reviews that the book's enjoyed.
Yeah, it's been great, and I really loved it. As I said, it's on its second print run, so it's obviously hit the spot with quite a few people. So, listen, let's jump into it. Let's talk about the book, and I'm intrigued because it is, you describe it as a niche. I just found it really fascinating that we'd found a topic that really had not been covered anywhere. But let's start by understanding a little bit about aerial mine laying. How did it come about at the beginning of the war? And why was there such a desire to develop this sort of strategic approach?
Okay, so ideas about aerial mine laying had first formed during the First World War, I think, but basically they didn't have the correct kind of aircraft. The technology didn't just exist. It was a theoretical possibility. But between the wars, some further work was done on this, and certainly in the late 1930s, plans were beginning to put in place to develop a mine which could be laid by aircraft to target enemy shipping and logistics. And that's what it's all about. So first of all, I'll mention, what is a mine? Well, when people think about mines, they think about those, you know, black and white war films from the 1940s and 1950s with downed airmen bobbing around in dinghies and, you know, and fending off these big black spherical objects with an oar or whatever. That's not the kind of mine that we're talking about. Those are naval mines. We are talking about aerial mines, which are laid from an aircraft. To all intents and purposes, they look a lot like a bomb. They are sort of large canister shapes, a couple of meters long, but with a parachute attached at one end to slow the descent. I'll explain a little bit about why mine laying was considered to be important and what the point of it actually is. So I think to begin with, we need to distinguish between defensive and offensive mine laying. So defensive mine laying is the laying of mines in one's own waters to protect shipping, ports, harbours and supply routes, etc. Offensive mine laying is the laying of mines to target enemy shipping in his own or in neutral waters. And that's what Bomber Command's mine laying campaign was all about. Now, what we're targeting in particular here is merchant shipping and logistics. It's not about going out, you know, into the far reaches of the ocean and trying to sink the Bismarck. It's about targeting your supply ships, your fuel ships, your troop carriers, that sort of thing. Your parts coming from wherever, your raw materials, your iron ore coming down from Norway and from Spain. So it's all about logistics. And as I've said, although the concept of using aircraft to plant mines was envisaged before, well, even before the outbreak of the First World War, it's not until the Second World War that aircraft are actually able to mine in any great quantity. You've got three significant advantages of aerial delivery rather than laying mines via ships. First, you've got speed and flexibility of response. Aircraft can get in and get out quickly. Second, the capability of replenishing the field without the risk of self-inflicted damage. So if a ship lays mines and then has to go back and lay some more, it's got to dodge around all the mines it's just laid and is in serious danger of sinking itself. Aircraft don't have that problem. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, there's the ability to lay mines in shallow waters. So we're talking about rivers, we're talking about canals, we're talking about harbours. So all the places where the Royal Navy can't get to, Bomber Command can reach. So right within enemy territory, mines can be laid in those places by Bomber Command's aircraft. And that's really what it's all about.
And Jane, sorry to interrupt you there. What was the driver behind this? You know, you talk about logistics and merchant ships. Why was there such a need to lay these mines to stop these activities? What was the primary drivers coming for that?
I think it's kind of almost carrying on from the concept of blockade warfare, which was very sort of popular in the First World War, particularly towards the end of that conflict. It's sort of bringing that concept up to date. It's all about depriving your enemy of freedom of movement in his own waters. And I think that's something which can be done by aircraft in a manner which cannot be possibly done by naval vessels. And I think the drivers were there from sort of late 30s onwards. I think as aircraft were developing, both the Admiralty and RAF Bomber Command were pretty much singing from the same hymn sheet here. They both realised that aerial mine laying was going to be a thing in any future upcoming conflict, and were very keen to try and get something developed as soon as possible in the late 30s. That's something that I'll come on to in a little bit more detail as we go along and we discuss the role of Arthur Harris.
So gardening, how did the term gardening come about? What did it do to help us and limit intelligence leaks?
Okay, so these operations, these aerial mine laying operations, were codenamed gardening. When the operations began in April 1940, one of the RAF bigwigs, Norman Bottomley, had written to Five Group headquarters to announce that there would be new special nomenclature for these new top secret operations. And what he said was, "The word mine is being bandied about far too openly and wholesalely apropos of these pending operations. If we go on like this, it will be worldwide property in a matter of days, if not hours. We've therefore decided to employ the following nomenclature. Operations in connection with the M mine are to be called gardening. Generic term for the weapon is to be vegetables. If this system is agreed, it will be possible to carry on the necessary fairly open communication by teleprinter," so this is the distribution of the orders, etc., "without broadcasting it in plain language what it is all about." Thus, the term gardening entered the lexicon of the Royal Air Force. So you have your weapons, your mines, and labelled vegetables, and your individual minefields all around the coastal areas of Northern Europe are given horticultural or agricultural names such as zinnias, forget-me-nots, chrysanthemum, daffodils, that sort of thing. So if in the unlikely event that any sort of German wireless operator got hold of one of these coded messages, he would be looking at something which said, please plant 5 vegetables in forget-me-nots and marigolds. And he'd be going, what is this? What does it mean? It's, you know, it's completely gobbledygook.
Yeah.
And it worked, you know. I mean, it could have been anything. It could have been dog breeds. It could have been, I don't know, cricket terminology or whatever. But this is what was chosen, and it was suitably sort of
It was quite successful right throughout the campaign as well, wasn't it? It didn't really get broken by the Germans.
No, they didn't really cotton on. The thing is, with mine laying, obviously the Germans knew that we were doing it. You know, they could see that the aircraft coming in, flying in low over the coast, flying up the canals, rivers, estuaries, whatever. And then, you know, lo and behold, 48 hours later, all their ships would start disappearing. So it wasn't a secret that the operations were taking place. And in a way, you kind of want to know, you want your enemy to know that these operations are taking place, because then you are forcing him to divert his resources. You're forcing him to send his minesweepers out. You're forcing him to use, you know, valuable time, manpower, raw materials, etc., building more minesweepers, building more anti-aircraft guns, you know, recruiting people to go out and man these minesweepers and things. So in a way, that's kind of part of the intention. It's basically about being a complete pain in the backside. That's what mine laying is all about.
Okay, we talked briefly about what air-dropped mines were. How did they work, and what was the impact on operations?
Okay, so there were several types of airdrop mines that were used throughout the campaign. Now, this campaign begins in April 1940, and it continues right up until the beginning of May 1945. And during this time, technology does change and does evolve somewhat. There are basically three types of mine. There are contact mines. Self-explanatory, goes off when it comes into contact with another object or a vessel or whatever. And there are two kinds of influence mines. These are influenced by sound, acoustics, so the engine noise from a ship passing overhead will trigger one of these mines. And the other kind is magnetic mines, so they are triggered by a large metal object, i.e. a ship or vessel, passing overhead. Now, we need to get away from the idea that these mines suddenly cause, you know, a massive sort of ball of fire and explosion. That's not how they work. They work through the process of cavitation. So when a mine is triggered beneath the water, it creates a pressure wave. And it's this pressure wave that does the damage to the vessel. In the vast majority of cases, it will be powerful enough to break the back or break the spine of the vessel, which will then hopefully sink. So that's how it works. So you're not talking, it doesn't work in the same way as a bomb. It's a completely different and very sort of advanced technology. You know, it's a very special piece of kit and a very expensive piece of kit.
And were they heavy? Were they bulky? Were they cumbersome? How did they work with the aircraft? What was the effect on the operation of the aircraft?
Okay, they're not especially heavy. You're probably looking around about 1,500 pounds, between 1,000 and 1,500 pounds. There were some larger ones towards the end of the war, but I mean that's still a substantial amount. So the early aircraft which laid these mines was the Hampden. And they could only initially carry one, later two. But as the war progressed and the bombers got bigger, the heavy bombers came along, eventually Halifaxes and Lancasters and even Stirlings were dropping 4, and sometimes in the case of the Lancaster, 6 of these mines by sort of mid to late 44. But interestingly, we'll come on to aircraft types as we go along. Every bomber type operated by the RAF during the course of the Second World War from 1940 onwards was adapted to carry mines. And I think that is testament to just how important the RAF and the Air Ministry actually viewed these operations.
Yeah. You mentioned Arthur Harris. There wouldn't be a discussion about Bomber Command if his name didn't come up at some time. What was his role in the mine laying campaign? How did he see it, and how did he see it and was involved throughout the war?
Well, there's this myth. Whenever you mention mine laying to people, first of all, they say, oh, yeah, that was the easy option, wasn't it? And then they say, oh, yes, Arthur Harris thought mine laying was a complete waste of time. Both of those things are completely and utterly wrong. And I take great pleasure in correcting people when they come up with those arguments. Yeah. So Arthur Harris was one of the first proponents of aerial mine warfare. So in 1936, long before he is, you know, Commander-in-Chief of Bomber Command, he writes to the Air Ministry and the Admiralty saying, I think we need to develop an air-laid mine. And he puts forward this specification for an air-laid mine, round about the same time that the Admiralty, as I mentioned, are coming up with similar sorts of ideas. So he's sort of almost a visionary, if you like, in terms of aerial mine warfare, I would say. And from the get-go, it's something which he is pushing all of the time. So he is in charge of Five Group when the campaign first begins in April 1940. And it's his aircraft which are being used to carry out the initial mine-laying operations. And he embraces this campaign with enthusiasm right from the very outset. And when he takes over Bomber Command in February 1942, he is pushing and pushing and pushing, and he eventually sees mine laying rolled out on an absolutely industrial scale. I mean, we are talking about thousands and thousands of mines being laid every year. So I think the idea that he was in some way against it is untrue. I know where people get that from. It's in the early part of 1944. He's grumbling about sort of lack of resources, and he's saying, you know, you're expecting me to do bombing, you expect me to do mine laying. This is all in the run-up to the invasion, obviously, and I just can't be sort of everywhere at once. And I think that's where people sort of think, oh, you know, he's complaining about mine laying. He's not. Yeah. He's complaining about sort of having to be all things to all men, basically, at that point in time. But yeah, Harris is absolutely instrumental to the success of the campaign.
And you mentioned capacity there, you know, particularly later on the war, But let's go back to how Bomber Command structured itself. How did it prioritise mine laying within within its strategy, which evolved during the years of the war, but especially towards the end as the bombing war intensified? How did Bomber Command structure itself?
There's a myth that mine laying was a drain on Bomber Command's resources. But if you examine the archival documents and the policy which was implemented at the time, Bomber Command's resources were shepherded in such a way that both bombing and mine laying could take place simultaneously. These were operations which were complementary rather than in conflict with each other. And the way that that was achieved, again, this is more or less down to Harris, is that a policy was adopted of bombing in good weather and mine laying in bad. So when the weather, particularly in the winter, because all these operations are done at night, bear in mind, when the weather is too bad to send your bombers over to Germany, the poor mine layers will be out mine laying around the coasts of Holland, around the coasts of Denmark, northern Germany, Norway, etc. And by adapting that strategy, it meant that Bomber Command's aircraft weren't sitting around doing nothing when they couldn't be bombing. Instead, they were continuing to take the war to the enemy and continuing to cause disruption and destruction.
And as a result of that, Jane, how were there particular units focused entirely on mine laying, or was it mixed amongst the various elements of Bomber Command?
No, it was something that just about all of the bomber groups, I think apart from one, did throughout the course of the war. Initially, it was, as I say, just five groups, but then it was gradually rolled out to all of the other groups as well. It wasn't considered to be a specialised role. There weren't certain crews sort of specially trained to carry out mine laying operations. There weren't certain squadrons, you know, set apart just for carrying out these operations. They couldn't be. There weren't the aircraft and there weren't the crews to be able to do that, unfortunately. That was a luxury that the bomber command didn't possess. So everybody, if you go through sort of your average RAF bomber command crewman's logbook, at any point in the war from probably 42, 43 onwards, it's very likely that he will have undertaken at least one mine laying mission. Now, The policy kind of like waxed and waned throughout the course of the war. Initially, it was considered that this would be a good job for rookie crews to undertake as a first operation. But when losses began to mount, that policy was changed. It kind of, as I say, waxed and waned throughout the course of the war. But again, that's another myth associated with mining, that it was the easy option, that it was used as a milk run to sort of train in new crews, sort of get their eye in, etc. I'll give you an example. In 1943, 10 Squadron, I think something like, was it 101 crews joined 10 Squadron throughout the course of that year? And only one of those crews was afforded a mine laying operation as its first operation. So that tells you, you know, what the operational sort of constraints and requirements actually were. And it was dangerous, you know, and it was technical, but, you know, we'll come on to that in a little bit more detail. But no, there were no specialist crews, there were no specialist squadrons, and indeed there wasn't even any specialist training. In the OTUs and the HCUs, there was no specific training devoted to mine laying. There wasn't even a mine laying manual until about early 44. Yeah. It was just a question of, right, here you go, your mines have been loaded up, fly to these coordinates, drop them here and come on. That was about it, really. The Luftwaffe had this lovely fancy manual with all these coloured diagrams and, you know, all this kind of thing, because they undertook aerial mining with some success in British waters as well, particularly in the early stages of the war. But no, it was kind of, it was almost like the poor relation. But I think a lot of that was due to the fact that it was a joint operation with the Admiralty. And I think certain sections of the RAF didn't really understand what it was about, what it was for. They thought, oh, it's just a job that, you know, that we're just doing a favour for the Navy here. And it absolutely was not that. It was very much a joint operation between the Admiralty and the RAF. Indeed, there was a team of specialist mine warfare officers co-opted from the Admiralty, from the Navy, to Bomber Command headquarters in High Wycombe for the duration of the war, particularly Captain de Mowbray and Captain Cowie, who I talk about a lot in the book. And they were there and working with as part of Bomber Command, you know, for the entire duration of the mine laying campaign. So it was very much a joint effort. And I think Arthur Harris really recognised the naval contribution. Bomber Command don't know anything about tides and shipping movements, you know, and in water depths and that kind of thing. That's what the Navy do. That's the Admiralty's speciality. So the Admiralty is choosing the targets and saying, right, okay, Bomber Command, we need you to, it's going to be some major shipping movements in these shipping lanes on such and such a date. We want you to go in and drop your mines and, you know, and cause as much damage as you can on these particular dates. So the Admiralty would decide on the targets, but Bomber Command had complete operational control as to how and if those mines were actually delivered. If the weather was too bad, or if there were particularly sort of, you know, big bombing raids on at the time, they would say, no, sorry, can't do it then. We'll do it on such and such a date instead. So it's this sort of to and fro between the two. And I think that's something which often gets missed. But again, it's something that I really wanted to bring out in the book.
Yeah. Okay, and let's talk a little bit closer to home in the RAF then, and talk a little bit about, I suppose, politics and doctrinal clashes. Coastal Command, you know, something that was passionate to me, and I and we did quite a lot of focus on a year or two ago on how RAF Coastal Command delivered its services. How did Bomber Command and Coastal Command work together in laying mines? Because I would imagine Coastal Command thought it was their job.
Well, this it caused a lot of conflict. Coastal Command didn't really want to do it because they felt that they lacked resources, which is a problem that they obviously struggled with throughout the entirety of the war. They were always the poor relation, the Cinderella service, weren't they? However, they did play a very important and significant role in the mine laying campaign in the very early stages. So between 40, probably up to the end of 42 into early 43. But then after that, Bomber Command took over mine laying completely, mainly because Harris wanted to sort of control operations himself, but also Coastal Command really didn't want to be involved. And the reason for that was that they couldn't see the point. They thought it was a complete waste of time, and they were also suffering quite heavy losses. Now, if you look at the aircraft that Coastal Command were utilising at this particular time, so we were talking about, you know, the first couple of years of the campaign, sort of 41, 42, they are using Swordfish. So some Swordfish squadrons had been co-opted from the Fleet Air Arm and were being used by Coastal Command to carry out their mine laying operations. And I mean, I'm as much a fan of the string bag as anyone. I think they're absolutely wonderful aircraft. But they could only carry one mine. You know, it's not a great use of your resources, and their loss rate was particularly high. I'll just sort of share with you an extract from a report by a Coastal Command senior intelligence officer, which was produced in August 1941 for 19 Group. And he was absolutely scathing of the mine laying operations. He thought there was, you know, there was no satisfactory results. And he said, and I quote, "These gardening operations and their very unsatisfactory results have immobilised a number of our aircraft which might be doing more useful work against shipping. The amount of tonnage sunk by direct air attacks by aircraft of Coastal Command and Bomber Command far exceeds the tonnage sunk by gardening. The limited number of aircraft in this group would be better employed and would obtain better results by air attacks on shipping." He was completely wrong about that. The research that I've done and that others have done before me is very, very clear that air-laid mines were a much more economical way of attacking enemy shipping than by direct attacks. The loss rates for direct attacks in terms of RAF and Coastal Command aircraft were horrendous, and it's extremely difficult to bomb a moving target at sea with any great success. So mining is sneaky. They don't know that the mines are there most of the time, and it's incredibly, incredibly successful, as we'll go on to discover. But yes, there was a lot of conflict between the two branches of the RAF about this. And in the end, Joubert, who was leading Coastal Command in 42, after some discussions with Harris, it was decided that the Coastal Command would withdraw from these operations altogether. And that was fine as far as Harris was concerned. He was happy about that ultimately, because it meant it gave him complete control. It meant that, you know, his aircraft could be delivering mines in greater numbers, because obviously they've got the capacity to do so and the size to do so. So in the end, that I think that was probably a sensible policy and strategic decision to take.
Yeah. So over the course of the war, Jane, technology moved forward quite dramatically, and I'm sure in mine laying and mine types, the technology advanced really quickly. Can you just talk us through some of the changes that happened during the course of the war?
Yes, this was sort of mine warfare was developing at a really, really fast pace during this time, because obviously when your enemy begins to sweep mines, he in some cases will be able to gain access to mines which aren't sort of which don't explode. He can strip them down. find out what technology you're using, and then introduce countermeasures, as we did exactly the same too in respect of the German mines. So you had to be sneaky. So mechanisms were introduced whereby, for example, a mine could be laid and it wouldn't go off. It wouldn't be triggered until it had been passed over by a ship four or five or even six times. So the enemy would be convinced that he swept this area. You know, I've been backwards and forwards with a minesweeper up and down this this area five times, convinced that there's no mines there. And then on the sixth time, bang. And then the mines were also developed to include combinations of acoustic and magnetic trigger mechanisms as well. And there were sterilization mechanisms fitted. What that means, that a mine would be rendered sort of inactive after a period of about what 6 months, 6 weeks. You could set it for whatever you wanted, which was useful, particularly when we are talking about the main mine laying in support of the invasion in June 44, when obviously large numbers of naval vessels would be coming across the channel and don't want to get into areas that have just been mined by Bomber Command. So these mechanisms were set very, very specifically to disable the mines sort of within D-Day plus 2 days, 5 days, 6 days, 13 days or whatever, so that naval vessels could then begin to get access closer to shore. So it was all very clever. Yeah. So yeah, it was a constantly evolving technology. And then of course from the aircraft themselves as well, there was changes in technology, because initially these mines had, and this is something which I think we'll come on to, had to be laid from a very, very low altitude between 500 and 1,000 feet to ensure accuracy. But as technology changed aboard the aircraft, and you've got your H2S and your navigational aids, etc., gradually the aircraft are able to drop from higher and higher altitudes, so 5,000 feet, then 10,000, then 13,000, and eventually by the end of the war, mines are being laid from like 15,000 feet, which was, you know, unthinkable in 1941.
Yeah. So tell us about mine delivery and how it differed from traditional Bomber Command missions, particularly for the crews. What made them a bit more psychologically taxing for the crews compared to standard bombing sorties?
Right, let's go back to the sort of technical aspect then. When you are laying a mine, it has to be laid to very specific coordinates, because it has to be laid in specific shipping lanes or in a specific harbour or a specific canal. A canal is not a very big target. So it needs to be in these specific places and needs to be laid at specific times to take into account tide movements, to take into account anticipated shipping movements. Ships don't just sort of go out and sail randomly around the North Sea and around the Channel. They stick to specific shipping lanes. And this is what Bomber Command are targeting. There's no point just, you know, adopting a scattergun approach and hoping that one of your mines is eventually going to trigger and sink a ship if it happens to sail over it in 6 months' time. You've got to be very, very careful and very precise about where you lay them. And for that reason, Bomber Command crews, if they were unable to lay their mines successfully for whatever reason, for example, they couldn't look at the target or there was too much enemy action or whatever, they were instructed to return the mines. They had to bring them home, unlike bomber crews who would just jettison their bomb load on the way back into the ocean. Now, in the early days, as I've said, delivery had to be, to achieve this level of accuracy, it had to be done from a very, very low altitude. So if you are laying a mine in, say, the harbour at La Palice outside the U-boat pens, that's a very, very small target area. You've got to come in low. You have got to sort of calculate where you are by using dead reckoning initially. So they will be sort of choosing a landmark on the shore and sort of calculating their approach and run from that initially, because they didn't have the navigational aids to do otherwise. So it was a very complex and very sort of tedious operation as far as the crews were concerned. So they're doing this at low altitude. And bear in mind what I've said about the strategy of bombing in good weather, mining in bad. The vast majority of occasions they'll be doing this in bad weather in the middle of winter, so in the sleet, snow, risk of icing on the aircraft. Because of where you are laying your mines, so very, very close into coasts, harbours, ports, estuaries, rivers, as I've said, you are going to be facing significant enemy anti-aircraft defences. So it was extremely dangerous from that point of view. It's tedious. It involves a great deal of concentration, particularly by the bomb aimer and the pilot. You're just looking for a patch of sea or a patch of ocean. You're not looking at a big, great big, Krupp's factory. You're not looking at, the city centre of Berlin or whatever. There's nothing to actually see. You are looking for, you are aiming for a very, very small patch of ocean generally. So it was dangerous and it was taxing for the crews. It was extremely tedious for them, particularly on the longer trips. I mean, you could be flying, all the way down to almost the border with Spain, right into the bottom of the Bay of Biscay. You could be flying over Germany, over Denmark, into Kiel Bay, off towards Danzig, that sort of area. So there's this sort of misconception that Bomber Command crews were just sort of flying out into the middle of the North Sea and just dropping their mines randomly. Well, that's not what was happening. That's what the Navy is for.
Yeah, yeah.
These are close to shore or indeed inland in terms of the canals and waterways which are being targeted. And it's very, very dangerous for that particular reason. This is another myth that I often get presented with. Oh, mine laying operations didn't count towards your tour. That's absolutely rubbish. Of course they did. But that's a common misconception.
Yeah.
They absolutely did. And the operations were sort of, by mid-42, loss rates were spiraling really, so much so that Bomber Command commissioned a report from the operational research section, and they were looking at the various factors as to why so many mine laying crews were being lost, basically. And there were various sort of factors determined in this. There was obviously the low altitude, as I've said. The weather was a major factor. Coastal defences, particularly flak guns and flak barges just offshore. But also, they realised that the aircraft which were heading east, so towards Denmark, towards Kiel Bay, towards Danzig, had a much higher loss rate than those that were heading west down the French Atlantic coast. And so they had to adapt their policies and put in their more experienced crews to go on those eastern operations, and the less experienced crews were sent to the western minefields, the western gardens. So it's a constantly evolving situation, if you like.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
But with regard to the air crew sort of experience and how sort of dangerous and difficult it was for the crews, I'd just like to mention a couple of quotes from some of the airmen involved, if that's all right. Yeah. Okay. So this is a quote from a wireless operator, Andy Andrews from 10 Squadron, who I was very fortunate to interview a few years ago. He joined 10 Squadron in July 44, and he was actually shot down on a mine laying operation over Kiel Bay on the 14th of February 45. So you think, it's more or less over then, all bar, whatever, but it's absolutely not. It's still very, very dangerous. And Andy said, "We were tasked with laying mines in the German shipping lanes in Kiel Bay. The bomb aimer was in his position in the nose of the aircraft, locating the drop zone with the H2S. We were tagged by a Junkers Ju-88, which crept up on us and flew directly underneath. He fired his six cannons straight up under the belly of the aircraft, bracketing the front where we were sitting. He hit the petrol tanks. The port wing was a mess of flames. The pilot, who was sat immediately above me, was mortally wounded, and our navigator, who'd been sitting knee to knee with me, was killed outright. The aircraft was obviously out of control, and the G-forces made it difficult to stand or even move. I managed to clip my parachute on and tried to move towards the escape hatch and the floor of the nose. I never got there. The aircraft blew up at 18,000 feet, and I was knocked unconscious. To this day, I don't know how I got out, but the nose must have come off and left a gap for me, and the bomb aimer to fall through. Fortunately, I came to. Everything was silent as I'd gone deaf. I was able to pull my ripcord, and seconds later, I hit the ground. And again, there's another account from Flight Sergeant Fish of 153 Squadron, who described the hazards encountered by his crew. And he said, we carried six parachute mines, and as soon as these had been dropped, a German fighter appeared, obviously vectored onto us by ground control. We fired and corkscrewed and vanished into the cloud, but in the next 30 minutes, we saw three aircraft shot down. Our squadron lost one aircraft that night and had another badly damaged. Owing to heavy losses on guarding ops, the wing commander sensed the drop in morale and offered to go on the next op. His aircraft, plus another from 153, was shot down that night and all the crews were lost. If you went down in the sea at night, you didn't have much of a chance. So the hazards that the mine layers faced are, you know, they're no different to the crews who are flying over the Ruhr or, you know, are going to Berlin, Frankfurt or whatever. And loss rates broadly on gardening operations were round about the same across the course of the war as they were on standard bombing missions. Right. So looking at round about between sort of 3% and 4% overall. So that that's what the crews have got to contend with.
Sorry to interrupt you there, Jane. Before we talk about the aircraft and some of the aircraft involved, you know, they're quite sober in those stories. Did the air crews get less recognition for mine laying than for some of the more general bombing activities?
Very much so. Yeah, this was a constant problem throughout the war. And again, this was something which Harris was really, really fighting for. He was desperate to try and get some sort of recognition for his mine laying crews. The difficulty with mine laying is there's no instant results. You know, it's not like a bombing operation where you wheel away, you take your photographs of your bombs, you know, dropping and the damage, the smoke, the mayhem on the ground, the fire, columns of smoke. There's none of that with a mining operation. What do you see? If you're lucky, you might see a splash as the mine falls into the water, but that's it. You don't know whether your mine is going to cause any damage. You don't, by the time it's actually being triggered by a vessel, it could be 6 months later, you know, and you could have been off the squadron for months by then. So the mine laying crews never really got to know the results of their endeavours. It's not something that was widely publicised at the time. It was very much sort of played down in the media. You know, there'd be reports on the bombing operations over Germany or whatever. And then the newspapers, there will be a line at the bottom of the reports, and mine laying operations continued, as if it's some sort of like routine, tedious, general, unimportant task. And I think that was very much the opinion that people had about it and continue to have about it today, that's something that's persisted. Yeah. And Arthur Harris was desperate to try and get the recognition. He battled the Admiralty, he battled the Air Ministry, he was writing letters to MPs, he was complaining to Parliament, all to try and get some recognition for the work, the dangerous work that these air crews were doing.
Yeah, very sobering stuff. So tell us about the aircraft that we used. You mentioned that, in effect, mine laying ran throughout all the squadrons throughout the whole year. But were there any specific aircraft types that were used at particular times in the war?
Yeah. So at the beginning of the campaign, you have, as I'd mentioned previously, the Hampden. Then you go on to sort of Boston's and Manchester's. You've got the Blenheim. That you've got the Bristol Beaufort, even. You've got the Fairy Swordfish. You've even got the Botha. You've got absolutely everything that you can think of. But then obviously as the heavies come on board, the bigger bombers, you've got Whitleys, you've got Wellingtons, you've got Halifaxes, you've got Lancasters, of course. But then you've also got your Mosquitoes, who mined very, very successfully indeed, particularly in the low-level operations against the canals and also in the Danube. People forget that the Danube was mined very, very heavily by Bomber Command, particularly through late 44 and into early 45, because they were trying to disrupt the delivery of oil from the Romanian oil fields, and also the evacuation of troops from the Eastern Front as well. And that was, the Danube was mined with great success by many different aircraft types, but certainly the Mosquitoes were involved. So yeah, the list that I have here begins with Handley Page Hampden, Short Stirling, Armstrong with Whitley, Douglas A-20 Boston, Avro Manchester, Vickers Wellington, Bristol Blenheim, de Havilland Mosquito, Handley Page Halifax, Consolidated B-24 Liberator, Avro Lancaster, Bristol Beaufort, Blackburn B-26 Bolta, and the Fairy Swordfish. So yeah, just about everything you can think of there, really.
Wow. Let's take a step back then, Jane. What do you say was the most single most successful mine laying operation of the war?
Was there
one that stands out?
I would say there are two. I would say the operations in the Baltic and the waters between Denmark, Sweden and Norway were particularly successful. If you look at a map of that particular area, you'll see how narrow the channels are, the belts and the sounds, etc. Any traffic coming from Germany was forced to go through these narrow waterways, which made them absolutely perfect for mine laying because, you know, there's nowhere else to go. And particularly in the early years, huge numbers of vessels were sunk. You know, people say to me, oh, how many vessels, you know, well, did Bomber Command sink through their mines during the course of the war? You know, was it, what, 50, 100 maybe? And I was like, well, no, it was around about 750. You know, it's a substantial number of shipping and tonnage of shipping, which is destroyed. So that, the area, as I say, around the Western Baltic, around approaching Denmark and up towards Sweden and Norway was a very successful hunting ground for the mine layers. But also, I think you need to consider the amount of mine laying which was undertaken in 1944 in preparation for the invasion. So we're talking about sort of around the channel ports. Huge amount of mines were laid. I think there was something like 11,000 mines laid in the period of about seven Gosh. Weeks immediately prior to the invasion. And it worked, you know. How many naval vessels were sunk by submarines?
During the invasion, of course, because that was
the whole point. It's to keep the submarines basically in their home port, so they can't get out. You know, they can't come and attack the invasion fleet. Yes, you know, the U-boats and S-boats and things can come out, but you know, the subs are pretty much confined to base during this time. It would just be suicide for them to venture out.
And were there any areas where it just didn't work?
The campaign is often criticised for failing to sink larger numbers of U-boats. I think there was something like 10 sunk by mines throughout the course of the war. But it wasn't for that. That wasn't the intention. The way that mines were used against U-boats was to disrupt their movement, to keep them confined to base, to force the minesweepers out, to delay their sailing. It's all about disruption and depriving the enemy of his sea routes, basically. And to that extent, it was successful. But if you're, you know, saying, oh, well, you know, it didn't sink very many submarines. No, it didn't, but it wasn't for that. And I think that's a misconception about what the purposes of the campaign actually were. And obviously, submarines are operating in much deeper water. Air-laid mines are designed to operate in shallow waters. So yes, you know, you might nab a few subs in the Oslo Fjord, or you might, you know, damage some coming in and out of La Palice or La Rochelle or whatever. But you're not going to get them when they're sort of significantly submerged at depth, at, you know, at the operational depths, because you're not going to be laying mines in those areas. Again, that's what the Navy's for. That's not what Bomber Command air-laid mines are designed to do.
So taking a complete step back then Jane, and bringing the book to its conclusion, what do you think was the major contribution that mine laying, air mine laying had on the Allied war effort?
I think it's very much a contribution which has not been recognised until now. 14.5% of all Bomber Command operations were mine laying, which is not an insignificant amount. Wow. 14.5%.
Yeah.
And people just aren't aware of that. I was interviewing someone the other week on my podcast, and he was saying, well, of course, you know, 99% of what Bomber Command did was bombing. I was like, no, excuse me, it wasn't. you know, and as I've said, I think we need to bear in mind that the air-laid mine campaign was much more successful in destroying and disrupting enemy shipping than direct attacks. And this was established very, very early in the campaign. You know, the figures were there. The evidence was there that more ships were being sunk. So it was recognised at a very early stage of the campaign that mine laying was a much more economical method of attacking enemy shipping than direct attacks on ships. I mean, the stats, which I've sort of set out in great detail and gone into to the nth degree in the book, you know, sort of all demonstrate this. But it's not just about sinking ships. And I think that's very, very important to bear in mind. It is about causing your enemy to divert his resources into minesweeping and anti-aircraft defences. So the minesweeping force that the Germans had to be increased by something like 40% as a result of Bomber Command mine laying. It's sort of between sort of late 42, 30, early 43 and into mid 44. So we're talking about a massive amount of manpower, raw materials going into building, you know, minesweepers, etc. But then there's also things that people don't think about, such as insurance rates are increasing hugely because so many vessels are being sunk and damaged. So lots of shipping is coming from Sweden. Lots of it is sort of leased and hired from Swedish shipping companies. And they're getting to the point where they can't get marine insurance anymore because so many vessels are being lost.
Yeah.
So they are then, you know, refusing to sail or to supply merchant vessels to the Germans. Likewise, many of the crews who man these merchant vessels are from neutral countries such as Sweden. And it gets to the point where they're just absolutely refusing to sail because it's just too dangerous. On the Danube, you've got crews from merchant vessels just basically abandoning ship, you know, the very next port that they
wow. yeah.
they get to and doing a bunk because they are seeing all of these vessels, you know, damaged, not necessarily sunk, but certainly damaged by mines as they are making their way up and down the Danube. So I think it should be seen as part of Bomber Command's overall strategy. It's not just a job that Bomber Command is doing for the Navy. So it's targeting enemy transport systems, waterborne systems, and logistics. At the same time, the bombing of railways and land-based logistics is going on. So if you are attacking railways and railway hubs with conventional bombing, you are forcing freight onto the rivers and coastal routes where they are then being picked off by Bomber Command's air-laid mines. And vice versa.
Yeah.
In areas which are heavily mined, freight is then forced onto the railways, which are then also being bombed. So it's all part and parcel of the same web, the same overall strategy, I think. And I think it's important that people recognise that this is not something which is in conflict or adjacent to the main bombing policy. It's something which works alongside with and complements it perfectly. The two sort of like yin and yang, if you like, they just work together really, really well.
We've discussed some of the areas that have never really been laid as open until books like yours have come out. If mine laying have received the same sort of level of publicity since the end of the war that the bombing campaigns had, how do you think we'd look back on the role and the perception of Bomber Command's legacy than we do today?
I think it will be very different. And one of the reasons that I wrote this book was that I wanted to change people's perceptions and understanding about Bomber Command and how it operated and why it did what it did throughout the course of the war. I'll just read you a quick quote from Air Marshal Saunby, in October 1945 from a lecture to the Royal United Services Institute. He spoke of the mine laying campaign in glowing terms. And he said, there could be no doubt that the persistent, unspectacular sea mining offensive was one of the most successful and economical contributions made by heavy bombers to the Allied victory. These operations, however, required great skill and determination and were not carried out without painful losses, but their repercussions were far-reaching. Even now, we don't know the full story. And the problem is, by the time the full story was known, by the time all the figures and stats, etc., had been amassed, nobody was interested. Nobody was interested in Bomber Command anymore. And nobody was certainly interested in mine laying. So, yeah, I think it would have portrayed Bomber Command's successes in a more positive light. There's another quote that I'd just like to mention, if you don't mind. So when we look at bombing, it did not achieve the much vaunted knockout blow that, you know, people thought it was going to do at the beginning of the war. It didn't bring out the destruction of German morale, nor did it deprive the German war economy of the ability to produce much needed aircraft and armaments. I think the cost to the Allies of prosecuting the bombing war against the German war economy in terms of investment resources, loss of men, machines, etc., was vast. 55,571 RAF and over 26,000 United States Air Force crew lost their lives, and thousands more taken prisoner or injured. I think if you look at the strategic bombing campaign in isolation, then yes, those criticisms are justified. But I think you need to add mine laying and the impact of mine laying into that equation. I don't think you can look at Bomber Command just solely in terms of bombing. As I've said, 14.5% of their operations were mine laying, and they had an incredible impact throughout the course of the war. And I think it's about time that that was recognised.
Absolutely fascinating, Jane. I loved the book, predominantly because it told me something that I didn't know, and I feel slightly guilty about that, but really enjoyed it. A couple of questions about the book. The cover, Jane, explain to us the picture on the cover.
Okay. So the cover shows a 10 Squadron Halifax. This is a later Mark II Halifax, ZAM, M for mother. And this aircraft was flown by my great uncle's crew. My great-uncle Jack Clyde was a wireless operator with 10 Squadron, and his pilot was Reg Pennicott. The crew called themselves Penny's Prangers, of course, what else? And this depiction on the front cover shows an operation which they carried out in March 1944. This was their penultimate operation, and it was a mine-laying operation against the U-boat pens at La Palisse, La Rochelle. And this operation was very nearly their last, and obviously they very nearly didn't complete their tour. It was a low-level operation, and they were coned in searchlights as they made their approach, and they had to keep going back about three or four times, getting away from the searchlights, making their approach again to eventually drop their mines. When they did do that, the bomb doors jammed. So they were sort of having to limp back with all sorts of problems. You know, they were shot at, and yeah, it was an extremely dangerous operation. I described the operation in great detail in the book, and there's some maps and what have you as well, which are relevant, and photographs of the crew, obviously. They did make it back, fortunately, and went on to complete their final operation, which was against the marshalling yards somewhere in France. But yeah, that was one of their stickiest operations. But this particular crew had undertaken 5 mine-laying ops, which is probably more than average, because this was at the time when Halifaxes were being taken off bombing raids over Germany, the Mark II Halifaxes, because they were suffering such high loss rates, and many of them were diverted into mine-laying operations at this particular time, which is why that they were doing so many. But yeah, so that's the story of the cover. So
that's got to be one of the best stories for a front cover I think we've ever heard. It's amazing. But that's what a front cover should be, shouldn't it? It shouldn't just be a picture of something to sort of become eye candy. It should be meaningful, and I think that's fabulous. So thanks for sharing that, and thanks for coming onto the show to talk to us about the book. Just before I do let you go, though, Jane, just want a quick update on Nevermind the Dambusters. Yesterday, listened to your sterling episode with Jonathan Faulkner. Fascinating, great listen. And just for me personally, the role of the Canadians as well in your new series just means a bit more, because my mum was liberated by the Canadians. So there's always something close to my heart. Really enjoyed it. And this is your second season. Have you got some good guests lined up? I'm quite excited to hear what's coming up next, or can you not share that yet?
It's our fourth season, Peter.
Four
already. Yeah, it's been 2 years. Can you believe
Over 2 years. Sorry, I do apologise. 2 years. Sorry, I got that wrong.
Yeah, it's flown over. We're absolutely loving it. Really, really enjoyed doing it. And the feedback that we've had from people all over the world, I think we're listened to in something like 124 countries now. And it's fantastic. We get so many people contacting us to sort of share their family stories and things. And it's just been wonderful. And we've sort of building a really lovely community around the podcast as well, which is great. Yeah, but coming up in this series, we've got some more fantastic guests. We've just had the Sterling episode released. Jonathan was a brilliant guest. This week coming out, we've got an episode on the mosquito. Then we've got Sean Feast talking about the raids on Peenemunde Munda and targeting Hitler's V weapons launching sites. What else have we got? We've got an episode with a German historian about bomb disposal in Hamburg. We've got a section coming up on Cold War bombers, because Bomber Command continued after the war. It wasn't just a World War II thing. We've got all sorts of really interesting topics coming up.
Exciting.
That's the thing with Bomber Command. We just never run out of things to talk about. It's incredible, really.
Where can we find, for those who don't follow you or know where to catch up with the latest developments on the podcast, where can we find you online?
Okay, you can find Nevermind the Dambusters on Twitter, or X as it is now, also on Blue Sky. And you can find our main website with links to all of the episodes at nevermindthedambusters.buzzsprout.com. Oh, and we're also on Instagram as well.
Wonderful. Jane, thank you so much again for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's been an absolute pleasure.
So we'd like to thank White Hearts for our music, and I'd personally like to thank those of you who have stuck with us over the last 13, almost 14 years. You really do make it worthwhile, and that's why we're back again for another new season. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on social media, and you can find Tim, Ellie and Gareth on the extended social feeds on Instagram, Facebook, Threads, Blue Sky, LinkedIn and Twitter X. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Jane.
Goodbye, everyone. Thank you.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. And use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. Programs produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended!
is XTP Media.